Welcome to Radio Gorgeous, Sophie Kinsella.
Hello. Thank you for having me on your show.
Your book, your latest book, is not in the Shopaholic series. Mm-hmm. It is My Not-So-Perfect Life, which could be the title for all of us. But tell me about My Not-So-Perfect Life.
Well, it's a book. I mean, I always write what I see around me, which is the same for the Shopaholic series or anything I've written. And in My Not-So-Perfect Life, I've looked at the way that all of us try to aspire to a perfect life, even if it's kind of a bit fake. And my heroine, Katie, comes to London, and she's grown up in the countryside. She's kind of fantasized about a perfect urban existence, which she sees as being quirky and glamorous and restaurants and all of these things. And the truth is, she can't afford any of this. She lives in a tiny flat. She has a hideous commute. She has dreadful office politics and a nightmare boss. And so when she goes online, it's not exactly that she lies, but there's a bit of fiction. She takes pictures of things that she, a cocktail that she hasn't drunk, and she posts it. And sometimes even strangers kind of laughing and having a great time. And so she projects this perfect, glamorous life that she wishes she had. And at the same time, she looks at all these amazing Londoners around her, and in particular her boss, who is an older female boss who seems to have it all. And she believes that her boss, Demeter, has the perfect life. And through various plot twists, they come apart, they come back together. She hates Demeter, then she finds out the real Demeter. And interestingly, the story is really one of two women. And it's not so much boy meets girl. It's really girl becomes woman she should be, meeting a woman on the way, meeting a guy on the way. But it's really one girl's journey. And really the discovery she makes as she goes along is that life isn't perfect. It can't be perfect. Let's not pretend it's perfect. It's just we're all humans and we're all flawed. And, you know, let's celebrate that and not be desperate for something else.
Yeah, it really reminded me, as we're sitting here with my leg in a cast. But it's good, you know, it's I guess we're surrounded by all these images of, you know, even just housing developments. You know, people, happy, laughing people, if you live here.
Oh, I know.
Luxury flat.
Yes, you know? Live the life. Yeah. I mean, all these hoardings. It's not enough to say this is a well-built property. This will keep you warm and you'll have some room for your stuff. It has to be all about the accessories. You'll have olive oil and you'll look, you'll have this handsome man living in your house with you. This is kind of the life they promise. And it puts pressure on. And therefore, it's not enough just to buy the house. You have to have all these kind of crisp white shirts and Sunday papers and of coolness.
Yeah, exactly. And a perfect dog. And
yes, the, exactly.
And the car.
And go to the gym all the time, by the way.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, and it's not realistic. And yet, I also think, I don't know that we were surrounded by that so much when we were growing up, that if it was such a constant message.
No, I don't remember lifestyle being such a thing. And I also don't remember must have being a phrase. And there's this kind of compulsion. Even watching property programs, you know, these renovation programs, which I love, I'm addicted to them. But this phrase, it's got to go. Yeah. You know, it kind of puts pressure on you. You know, you can't live with that dowdy carpet and that sort of, you know, chintzy wallpaper. It's got to go. And I agree. I don't remember. I mean, my mother says, you know, all this new bathroom. She said, well, you never had a new bathroom. You just had your bathroom. It just was generation to generation.
Yeah, you moved in.
Yeah. And
you had
just
a house.
It worked. It, you know, it kept you clean. And I do think that there's a sort of accelerating. I mean, I've noticed catalogues kind of going, cushions for spring. I mean, what?
I'm supposed to change them every season?
So, you know, this season's interior trends is this. And so, you know, you can understand why. It's a clever marketing ploy. But it's not great if people then feel insecure because they didn't change their cushions for spring. That's not good.
Yeah, and the sort of grungy student lifestyle, it has romance. You know, when I first moved to New York after college, you know, there was romance. We had nothing, but there was... I remember lingering outside a restaurant looking at the people because I was really hungry. That was once. But, you know, but there was, you know, you knew you were going to be poor and not afford anything. And, you know, that wasn't the reason. So, yeah, I think for younger people, it's really become very pressurized.
It has. And I think that it's relentless. This is the thing. I mean, we can all make an effort once in a while and sort of put on a good front and tell everybody we're having a great time. You know, you go to a party, you're full of smiles, you look your best. But with this 24/7 online presence, when do you relax? You don't really. You know, everything is upbeat, everything is glossy. And, you know, I mean, writing my not-so-perfect life, people have said, well, you know, what do you think of social media? As if I'm going to say, well, I'm not into it. I am into it. I love it. And I don't think you can blame technology. The technology is amazing. I love reaching out. I love talking to readers. It's great. But I feel like we've colonized a new planet. We're now all living on this planet, sort of waving at each other. And we don't quite know how to make it work for us. And if you are super confident life is great, then it's probably all you need to just enjoy yourself all the more. If you have insecurities, if you are naturally self-judgmental, self-critical, if you just have those vulnerabilities, then I think the danger is it makes them worse. And that's where I think the gap lies.
Yeah, because it's not as though that impulse hasn't always been there. You don't put crappy pictures of yourself up in your house.
Well, exactly. I mean, look at old-fashioned portraits.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
They've got slim waists, yeah. And they're wearing all their jewels at once.
Exactly. You know, so that's, I mean, it's that, that impulse is there. But yes, it's the relentless nature of it.
And
now,
I think also people can hide behind it. So, you know, back in the day, you went off to church with your whole family dressed up looking nice and the whole neighbourhood could see you. And it was like, look at us and our great family. But then in the afternoon, they saw you working in the garden maybe, or maybe not on a Sunday back in the day. But, you know, other times they would see you in the garden having a fight, whatever it was, the reality. But when it's all on screen, you can actually conceal the reality completely, and you can have your messy house, you can have your kind of angsty life and project a complete fiction.
Yeah, which is dangerous. I mean, it's sort of the taking the fake it till you make it model, you know, too far.
Yeah, you've got to be able to, you've got to be somewhat reasonable.
Yes, so within
exactly.
Reality here, people. But getting back to the book, I have to say the opening chapter, I literally was hooting with laughter.
Oh, there's well, thank you. I'm glad.
Of a hideous commute that we can all, you know, sort of get behind. Tell me about your writing in general, because I think you have a real knack. You know, people call it chick lit. But I think you have a real knack of not trivializing sort of everyday problems. You know, recognizing who we are. No, we are not in Syria. No, we are, you know, your audience is lucky enough to be able to buy a book.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That and have the leisure to read it. So that already denotes a certain level of, you know, an easy enough life. In terms of resources, etc. But I like the fact that you don't trivialize that. If it's going on in your life, it's going on in your life.
Well, I think so. I mean, I'm glad you see it that way. For me, all these aspects of life are worth taking seriously. And I think actually screen presence and screen life is just something which we're all coping with. And yes, it's not a war, but it's actually pervasive. I mean, how many people does it affect? Everyone. And so I've always felt that like the best entertainment and the best comedy has something real at its heart. It has a truth and it has something almost painful that you're laughing about, you're recognizing. But actually, afterwards, you perhaps think, oh, actually, there is a point there. And I've always tried to do that in what I do. And it's easy to sort of get bowled along by the story. And I really hope that I make people laugh, because that's really what I want to do. But at the same time, I want to make them think. I'm just not the style to, you know, bang a message home with a hammer. I don't feel that's my most effective way of getting it across. So I get it across with comedy. And I hope that people do, even if they don't realize it at the time, it's kind of made them think.
And so do you think, I mean, we were talking about social media and its effect on our lives, and it's being sort of different for us in our 40s than it would be for kids. And you have kids. So what sort of thoughts around that do you have?
Well, I find it really interesting because I know life before social media. And so I don't define myself by social media. I think if you've grown up with it, then the danger is that you think that that sort of is reality and you never step outside it. And I would sort of like to think that we can find a balance where you, for example, you don't define yourself by likes. Likes are great. Likes are wonderful. You know, it's wonderful to get, you know, a reach out from someone that you don't know. But are we saying that that is who we are? It's a different thing. So I think it's all about striking a balance. And I think that it's possibly easier to have perspective when you've grown up without that and you defined yourself in other ways. And I'm not saying that it was easy to be a teenager, whatever the situation. But I feel grateful that I was allowed to make my mistakes in private, I think. And that's the one thing that concerns me, is this sort of very public arena that people find themselves in. I think sometimes you need to be private and, you know, only a few people know what went on, not the whole world.
Yes. Yeah, viral used to only just be about infections.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Exactly.
When we were growing up, it was reserved for serious infection, you know, and not your bumbling mishaps.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's not as though bullying has gone away. I mean, we were bullied just in person. It was more personal.
Well, it was more personal. Yeah, it was up close and physical sometimes. Exactly. But it didn't come home with you on your phone, did it?
Yeah.
So I think that on the other hand, I think that people find tremendous support through social media. And I mean, these kind of forums where people are chatting, you know, all these mothers' forums where people can say, oh, you know, I'm having trouble breastfeeding. Now, in my day, you kind of asked your friend, and if she didn't have the answer, you were stuck. So it's an amazing force for good. It's, mm-hmm. So you can't kind of generalize. You just have to think, what is the best way to make this work?
Okay, so now I want to talk to you about Sophie Kinsella, the author. Because you started out like your shopaholic heroine, Becky Bloomberg, as a financial journalist.
I did.
So, and what was that journey like for you from financial journalist to what made you just start writing?
Well, I think you will understand better when you know how bad a financial journalist I was, and the fact that I was a financial journalist because that was literally the only job that even replied to my attempt to find work. I applied for everything that I possibly could, and the response that I got was from Pensions World. Pensions World magazine is where I started off, and I knew nothing about pensions, didn't really want to know about pensions. But I learned about writing, and I learned about filling the space when, you know, when you've got to and a deadline, and nodding my head and trying to look like I knew what I was talking about in a press conference. That was a valuable skill. And then I moved to another similar magazine, still in the same, writing about bank accounts. I mean, it was not what I wanted to be writing about. I just loved the words. And it was really sitting on the train, going to work every day and reading other people's novels, you know, avidly, that I suddenly thought, wait, I want to do this. So it was other people's works that kind of inspired me. And then once I'd had the idea, it just wouldn't leave me alone. I you know, got my first idea. I wrote it in my spare time on the train, and it sort of took me over. I was quite obsessed. And I was just amazed when it, you know, got published. And I mean, instantly it was like, well, do you have any more ideas? And so I said a fond farewell to pensions.
They become more interesting as you get older.
Well, actually, you know what, I could actually bore you with the interesting side to pensions. I won't right now.
So tell me why you chose to write under a pseudonym.
Well, I had already written under my real name. So that's how I started out. And I expected that to go on. I was lucky enough to have several books published. And then I had the idea for the first Shopaholic book. And I instantly knew I wanted it to be different. I wanted it to feel different, sound different. It was like a different voice. It was younger and it was a bit more confessional, a bit more honest, first person. So I decided to do it under a pen name. Also, I thought, well, I have no idea if this will work out. If it's a total flop, I'll just make out like I have no idea who this Sophie Kinsella person is.
Utter deniability.
Just distance myself from the whole thing. Yeah, so it seemed like a good plan.
Excellent. And then why did you reveal?
Oh, do you know, it was sort of coming out. I mean, the funny thing is that probably if this happened now, it would be out in 2 seconds. I remember one bookseller coming up to me when I was signing stock, and he had a Madeleine Wickham book and a Sophie Kinsella book, and he held up the Madeleine Wickham book with this author photo, and he said, "This is you, isn't it?" And I was like, "Okay, busted." But amazingly, it was quite easy otherwise to keep a low profile. But I kind of felt like it was edging out. People were starting to put two and two together. And then I wrote this book called Can You Keep a Secret? And it seemed the perfect time to reveal, because I had been keeping quite a secret.
Yeah. And was that fun to keep it? Was it?
Oh, it was so much fun. I can't tell you. It just is liberating. And actually writing the book under a pen name was liberating, because I wasn't trying to sort of carry on a genre. I had no expectations. Nobody knew I was doing it. And so I was able just to kind of head for the hills in whichever direction I liked. And it felt like a first novel.
Mm. And did that then become burdensome, keeping that a secret? And
it was tricky. I remember arriving at a party once, and a fellow author who was a friend of mine came beetling up and said, "Do you know if Sophie Kinsella's here?" And I sort of gulped, and I actually sort of took her aside and said, "Okay, there's something I need to tell you." And, you know, even silly things like checking into hotels, knowing which name I was under, this kind of thing. It's believe me, to this day, it's can be complicated. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's fun. I still think it's a fun thing to do.
Yeah, exactly. But sort of as the benign espionage
tang yeah, exactly.
to it. And tell me about your young adult novel.
Mm. Well, that was another fresh voice, if mm-hmm. you like, and again, was really rewarding. And the story came to me. It wasn't as if I sat down and decided I'm going to write for young adults. It was that the story came to me, and as I was telling it, I realised that I wanted this to be through the eyes and voice of this teenage character, because it's a family book. You have the protagonist, Audrey, is 14, and she's the one suffering from anxiety, and it's a little darker than what I've done mostly as an adult, but then there's comedy because she has a crazy, chaotic family around her, and she has a brother who can't stop playing computer games, and this mother who keeps finding diet tips on the Daily Mail and trying to force her family to follow them. So there's all of that, but the main sort of, I suppose, spine of the book is Audrey and her journey. And it's just been really rewarding to speak to a new generation, to have their response. It's been a relief that they've all said, you know, by and large, that they enjoyed it, and not that, you know, how lame is this? You think you can write in a teen voice? Huh. I did consult my own teenagers, actually, for that one, because I didn't want them to say, well, you know, we'd never say that, especially the computer gaming brother. I thought, if I get this wrong, I am toast at home. So I'm going to consult widely and try and get it right. And I hope I did. And it's just been very special for me to write that book.
Mm. And it may sound silly, but what advice do you have, especially to women who, regardless of their age, whether they're 14 or 54, writing? Because it seems to have really enriched your life.
Mm. Yeah, that is a really good way of putting it. Well, I mean, I think for me, writing has been about finding a voice. And I think that is, you know, if I'm asked for advice, I think finding a voice is just so key to what you're doing. And it can take time. There's sort of finding the voice of your characters, but there's also finding your narrative voice. What are you trying to say about the world? You know, where are you pitching it? I mean, as you said earlier, I take sort of a particular type of world issue, contemporary issue, and I love to examine those, and other people will have other arenas that they want to explore. And I think that you have to be kind to yourself and realize that the first stuff you write down may not be actually reflecting what you want to say. And sometimes it takes a while to be courageous. I mean, interestingly, when I started out, I wrote my first book when I was 24. And I was absolutely determined that it would not be the autobiographical first novel. I was just obsessed by this. So I went completely the other way. I wrote a book about 30, 40-somethings having kind of midlife crisis moments and all behaving rather badly, playing tennis. It's called The Tennis Party, and they get together and they drink lots and they try and rip each other off, and they're really, you know, quite naughty. But none of them is a 20-something journalist. They are all very... And I think I felt I want to earn my kind of writing stars by being... And then I got a bit older and I relaxed and I thought, okay, now I'm going to be a bit more honest, confessional, personal. And I wrote the first Shopaholic book. But it took guts, you know what, to be so honest and to write things down and think, well, I think like this. But, you know, I have no idea if anyone else thinks like this. In hindsight, it seems like, well, of course, it would strike a chord. But I didn't know that. And it took a while to kind of be courageous enough to just put that all on the page. So, you know, allow this to happen gradually. And I always also say to people, write the book that you would love to read. Don't try and please other people. You know, don't think about the audience. Just write something that you yourself would gobble up. And the chances are other people will gobble it up too.
Excellent. Sophie Kinsella, thank you so much for coming on Radio Gorgeous.
Well, thank you. It's been a treat. It's changed everything.